Good evening, everybody. Nice to see you all. My name is Danny Hoffman. I'm the director of the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies here at the University of Washington. Welcome to this fourth talk in the War in the Middle East series, The New Elites of X, Identifying the Most Influential Accounts Engaged in Hamas-Israel Discourse. Now, let me begin, as we always do at our Jackson School public events, by acknowledging that we are on Coast Salish territory, the traditional homelands of the Duwamish, Suquamish, Tulalip, Muckleshoot, and other indigenous peoples. The Jackson School understands that the international community includes sovereign American Indian tribes, First Nations, and other indigenous peoples across the world. Now, I'm very pleased that once again tonight we welcome members of our own UW community to this stage. Kate Starbird, Mert Baer, Mike Caulfield, and everyone at the Center for an Informed Public have done extraordinary work across a whole range of issues. So we're honored to have them here with us tonight, sharing their expertise and contributing to this important series of conversations. Now, in just a moment, I'll turn the microphone over to Divisional Dean Andrea Woody to properly kick off the evening. But first, I want to remind you that as we have done for our previous talks, we'll be using slido.com as our platform for questions. If you would like to ask a question, go to slido.com, S-L-I-D-O.com. And when asked for an event code, the hashtag or pound sign JSISHUB, J-S-I-S-H-U-B. That's the keyword to get in. So for those of you who have been part of this series will no doubt recognize that it's taken a lot of support to pull this together. So I'd like to thank the UW President, Kausi, Provost Serio, and everyone in their offices for their support, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Diane Harris, and everyone in her office in the College of Arts and Sciences Communications and Advancement offices. Special thanks to the Jackson Foundation for their partnership and support, and my gratitude to the faculty and staff affiliated with the Middle East Center, Strom Center for Jewish Studies, the Jackson School's IT and communications teams, and especially to Monique Thorman. And most importantly, once again, I want to thank all of you for caring enough about informed discourse on important world topics to be here tonight. Now, before Dr. Rashad Kasaba comes to the podium to introduce our speakers, I've asked the College of Arts and Sciences Divisional Dean for the Social Sciences, Andrea Woody, to say a few words. Dean Woody has been a champion of this series from the very beginning, and I've been very grateful for her partnership and support in making these conversations a reality, and also for her broader commitment to ensuring that social scientists in the college and across the UW are visible and remain a critical resource for our community. So please join me in welcoming and thanking Dean Woody.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Andrea Woody. I'm the Divisional Dean of Social Sciences here at UW. I only want to speak for a couple minutes because I don't have any particular expertise and I have a great deal to learn from the panelists. But I want to do just a bit of framing. The foundation of a liberal arts education rests upon the cultivation of central intellectual skills for critical thinking, and for the capacity to take diverse perspectives, to frame issues first in one way and then in another. We exercise these skills when we empathize with the central character in a great novel, when we question the basic assumptions of our climate models, and when we attempt to infer the attitudes of citizens from the voting patterns of a fractured democracy. Roaming this campus, the intellectual work in our classrooms and our laboratories would seem so different in kind, place to place. We do so many different things. But under this surface of multiplicities, all the programs, all the degrees, all the options that in fact can be, make our undergraduates' heads spin, the commonalities are deep and profound. They're built on the shared values that animate everything we do. Public education is a social institution, one of the truly great social institutions, to my mind, built on the belief that human lives, both individually and collectively, are bettered by actualizing our cognitive capacities to learn, to know, and to communicate. I want to thank you for being here, for endorsing with your presence the value of gathering to learn and question and remember across our differences. It is to reaffirm the value of the skills at the heart of public education. I also want to thank all the people who have made this series possible, especially the faculty, staff, and leadership in the Jackson School of International Studies, a place that respects, cultivates, and studies human cultures across the globe with their unique social and political structures and their deep differences. I thank experts from across the UW campuses, our upper administration who helped facilitate this work, and all those from beyond UW who have joined us. For our speakers and our panelists, both up until now and tonight, I am so grateful for your time and your expertise and your humanity. We're here because there is a tragedy that is unfolding day after day in the Middle East. Violence, terror, destruction of entire communities, and the deaths of so many people who have so little power, who did not create the circumstances that can now make violence seem, from some perspectives, inevitable. We need and want better for the people whose lives have been uprooted, and worse, for Palestinians and Israelis and all those who live in Gaza. What can we do? Do these sorts of events make a difference? We're sitting comfortably in a room halfway around the world. I believe it is a way of bearing witness. I believe it is a way of recognizing our collective responsibilities in an increasingly global world. I believe it is a way of affirming our beliefs that analysis and empathy, interwoven, is the path to understanding, which is the precondition for real and lasting progress. So I thank you for being here. I offer advice, which in fact is the advice that has been given by our speakers so far, to educate ourselves about the history, about the cultures, about the complexities inherent in these places, to be critical of sources of information. And here I want to give a big shout out to UW Libraries. They have created a research guide that will give you background information about the history of this conflict and of the peoples who have inhabited these lands, as well as lots of links to news sources from across the world. And finally, the last piece of advice is to be willing to have difficult conversations. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Rashat Kasaba. Thank you.
Well, once again, thank you very much for being here. We are really happy to have the students and the community members and continuing with our mission of trying to learn as much as we can about this complicated issue from different perspectives. Learning about the issue, of course, is, depends on information and where that comes from and what's its content and how can it be used for good or bad are questions that have become increasingly central to our lives, as we know. The first time I met Kate Starbird was right around 2016 election when we were trying to figure out all the complicated machinations that went around that election. And I was fascinated with the research that she was doing. And since then, she's become the founding co-director of Center for Informed Public at the University of Washington. This is, as far as I know, the only or one of the very few interdisciplinary centers that tackles this question of information and misinformation. I think we're very fortunate at the University of Washington to have access to a program like that. The program, the center works around issues that they call rapid response teams, and they take topics that are current and study the information, misinformation that comes around that topic, and they present it to us. And their purpose, main purpose, is to resist strategic misinformation, promote and inform society, and strengthen democratic discourse. So I can't imagine a better mission than this, and I'm sure they're proud to have this on their website as their goal. The way we will do this is we have, in addition to Kate, two members of their rapid response team here. We will first hear a presentation about their work on the Gaza war, but in the context of this rapid response program. And then after that presentation, we will be on the podium and to have a general discussion and question and answer. The two other members of the center are Matt John Bayer, who is a postdoctoral scholar at the center, and Michael Caulfield is a research scientist at the center. The presentation will be given by Mert, and then after that, we will all participate in the Q&A. I will remind you again that we will use this Slido for the Q&A, and please download and then write your questions there, and then we will answer as many of them as we can. Because there are some slides, I think Matt will come up and do the slideshow, and then afterwards we will all come up and sit at the table. Thank you again for coming, Matt.
Thank you. I'll steal some water in any case. Thank you for inviting us to the Jackson School of International Studies, and thank you for everyone to be here. I'm very excited to be here. So I'll let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a political scientist. I work as a postdoctoral scholar, as Professor Kasaba pointed out, in Center for an Informed Public. Actually, this is the first report that I wrote with Center for an Informed Public. And it's such a report on such sensitive topic in Israel-Hamas conflict. So this is part of a broader work that we are doing in Center for an Informed Public. We are dealing with crisis events and information space in crisis events. And in our rapid response research, we are focusing on more about the election space, sort of controversial issues on crisis event and election space, such as rumoring and conspiracy theories. So when we have such a crisis as Israel-Hamas conflict in 2023, we have so much information going on, even in the first few hours of the conflict. Bombings, missiles, ambushes, militants, and a lot of things were going on in the first 3 days of the conflict. So when we wrote the report, we just, for instance, focused on the first 3 days, and that was a lot of things. So what kind of questions do we ask in these kind of crisis events? So very important questions, very fundamental questions, like what's happening there? When did it happen, right? Where is it happening? Why did Hamas attack Israel? Even though they probably were quite sure that they can't win the war? Or how did they, how were they this successful in the initial attacks and surprise Israel and intelligence? So these kind of questions are very, very important questions we deal with. And to answer these kind of things, we have some concepts such as information ambiguity, information uncertainty, and information convergence behavior that Kate Starbird will talk about more in the Q&A session. But I'll go to a little bit more detail about what do we do in these kind of crisis events, and what did we do in these kind of crisis events in the last decade. And I'll give you some examples from some crisis events in the last decade. So first one comes from Tahrir Square, the Egyptian revolution. And if you look at these two graphs, those are the number of tweets and retweets and number of users and unique users. during the revolution. And you can see that there's a huge spike in the tweets, retweets, user, unique users of Twitter. So that means that in these kind of crisis events, we are gathering in small spaces, online spaces, and we look for information in a similar manner. And it's similar in different contexts, such as when you look at Occupy Wall Street, you see similar spikes in information environments where people tweeting a lot about one case, and they're trying to find a lot of information about one case. And something that is closer to my home is Gezi Park protests from Turkey 2013. People online, everywhere in Turkey, were tweeting about these protests in 2013, and actually not just tweeting to learn about the events, but they were trying to communicate with each other. So this is in Istanbul, where Gezi Park is located. And you see those red dots are right in Gezi Park, where Gezi Park is located. And the reason why you see that is that we were trying to figure out where the police were, and so that we don't get tear gassed. So Twitter was allowing us to find out where the police were so that we could hide and avoid tear gassing. So people were trying to mobilize using Twitter. So it's not just bad things that were happening on social media, but they were mobilizing social protests. They were trying to avoid repression by states and other things. So social media and new media, digital media, however you put it, creates a lot of opportunities and challenges at the same time, where you can have conspiracy theories, problematic information, but also opportunities such as mobilization against repressive regimes. So what do we do is in these kind of crisis events that we seek information. And we converge in spaces like Twitter, like YouTube, like Instagram to find out what's happening. And we've seen a lot in Gezi Park, in Occupy Wall Street, in other spaces that there was something called citizen journalism, people tweeting on the ground about what was happening. And we saw that as something that was important for this decade of a new information and democratization of information supply, if you think about that. And also we thought a little bit more about it, and we said that, this new media, Twitter and other platforms, were creating and we're democratizing the space where we discuss things. So we were thinking that it's kind of like a digital town hall. And those are true, those are not wrong. But at the same time, every innovation has advantages and disadvantages. So we have been seeing a lot of stuff, for instance, anonymous accounts tweeting a lot of things, such as problematic information. And I'll give you a lot of examples of problematic information. And we have seen a lot of things, such as troll farms, state-sponsored disinformation, and we have experience in, for instance, in 2016, there was a foreign intervention in U.S. elections through new media. So, going back to Israel-Hamas conflict, what kind of questions did we ask? So we were wondering in the first days as users of information and new media, what was happening, right? What was happening in the music festival in Israel, for instance, right? You have all probably seen those videos, unfortunately. And who bombed the hospital in Gaza? What's happening in Gaza right now is also a crisis event question. So these kind of questions we ask, but there are other questions that we might ask which are, I think, as important as the other ones, is who supplied information to us in this event, and what kind of information did we consume? So what we saw in our report, and we wrote this report, The New Elites of X, by Mike Caulfield, me, and Ashlyn Ask. Ashlyn is not here, unfortunately. But what we found was this highest viewed accounts on X, on Twitter, were these seven accounts. And if you can read those accounts, if you're familiar with those accounts, if you recognize any of these accounts, can you please raise your hands so that I can see how many people can recognize that? Not many people, right? So these accounts were the highest viewed accounts in the 3 days, in the first 3 days of the conflict. So we call these as new elites, not because in a normative sense we call them elites, but as a sense of that they have a disproportionate power over supply of information. So they're a small group of people who supplied, who dominated the news environment in this crisis. So how dominant were they? So their tweets in the 3 days, these seven accounts that not many people know in this room, have been seen 1.6 billion times in total, whereas traditional accounts such as NBC News, BBC, you know, Reuters, New York Times, were only seen 112 million times. And if you look at in terms of the per tweet, their tweets had an average, the new elite's tweets had an average of 872,000 per tweet, and the news outlets that we often follow had 376,000 views per tweet. So this is very, very interesting. And it is more, it gets more interesting when you look at their number of followers. Because the new news accounts that we looked at have disproportionately more followers. The least one, which is the Reuters, I think, has 25 million. And BBC Breaking, CNN Breaking, sorry, has over 60 million followers on Twitter. And our new elites, who supplied most information, has fewer than 1 million per followers. So this is very interesting. How did this happen? Right. So here is a visualization of their tweets. The blue ones are from the traditional news accounts. And the bubbles represent each tweet. And the bigger the bubble is, more views. So you can see that 24 million BBC World, that I'm going to talk about in a second, is the highest for the news account. And as you can see, our new elites tweeted a lot. And their views are way, way, way more bigger bubbles. Let me put it that way. So if you just look at the tweets that got more than 10 million views, this is the picture you get. Most of those, one except one, is from New Elites, and only one is from BBC World. And that tweet is this tweet. And it is not because it got, this tweet got popular not because people were seeking information from BBC World, but people were trying to criticize BBC World. Because BBC World was saying that, you know, people, if you are a person in Gaza, you have been killed, but if you're a person in, oh, sorry, if you're in Gaza, you have been, you have died. If you're in Israel, you have been killed. So that was a place of critique for BBC News. Okay, so these new elites, who are these people? What did they tweet during this conflict, the first 3 days at least? And what can we tell about our news environment looking at these huge discrepancy between the new elites and the news, traditional news? So these are the accounts, and I'll talk more about them. So first one is Visegrad. Visegrad is a Polish conservative account that has been run by a small group of self-identified journalists, and they have been posting a lot about Ukraine war, and they took a little bit more of pro-Israeli stance in the conflict, in Israel-Hamas conflict. Mariana Fall used to be a host in Clubhouse application, if you're aware of that application. Then he transferred to X with the last 1.5 years, and he has been posting a lot of spaces in Twitter about various issues. Cent Defender publishes a lot about war, intelligence, and conflicts, and a American account. We don't know much about these accounts. Spectator Index have been around a lot, and it's an interesting account that only posts stuff about breaking news in the world. War Monitor was an account that got suspended last week when I was doing this creating this presentation. Then a few days later, I looked at they got their account back. And they tweeted a lot during this conflict. They tweet a lot about Middle East, and they took a pro-Palestinian stance in the conflict. And if you go back to Scent Defender was a little bit pro-Israeli. Maria Nafal was quite neutral in terms of their language. Spectator Index was also very neutral. And Kolinrag is our last one, and they identify as American and quite, favorable to Tesla products, as you can see. The last one, Censored Man. And we don't know much about Censored Man again, but we know that they got a lot of popularity during the Andrew Tate discussions. So why did we see these accounts dominate the news environment? There are multiple reasons. First reason is they had been endorsed by Elon Musk in one way or another. Second reason is that they published and posted things in the framing of breaking news every 5 minutes. And a lot of images, videos, and often graphic imagery they used. So, Elon Musk, in the first days of the conflict, endorsed War Monitors and Scent Defender as good sources to find information. Then there was a Washington Post article. Then he deleted this tweet. So Elon Musk still followed, at the time we were writing the report, subscribed into War Monitor and Scent Defender. Right now, he doesn't follow those accounts. I'll tell you later. And he endorses or at least boosts popularity and visibility of Maria Nafal and Kolinrag quite frequently by joining Maria Nafal's Twitter spaces and responding to them quite often. So these two, the first two columns are when we were doing the report, and the third one is right now. So as you can see, Scent Defender, War Monitors, Musk was following and subscribing a little bit. Then he stopped, but he still follows Maria Nafal and Kolinrag. And he responses and replies to Maria Nafal and Kolinrag frequently. And one way that we found that these accounts were boosted was this way, by Elon Musk's popularity in the platform. So these accounts are interesting, not just because they dominated the news environment, but because they don't have a common agenda or they don't have an overarching ideology. As I told you before, some of these accounts are pro-Palestinian, some of them are pro-Israeli, and some of them were not that, they were quite net neutral in the conflict, in the ways that they covered the conflict. But there are important similarities. The style that they post is very similar. The way that they frame their tweets as breaking news is very similar. The way that they use emotionally loaded language, content, and videos, very similar. They have very minimal references to sources of the information. That is common. And oftentimes what ends up being is that you read tweets without context. And I'll give you some examples. So this is a tweet from Maria Nafal, and I'll let you read it. It says, "Breaking, police shoot and apprehend suspect accused of killing two Swedish soccer fans on Brussels street, source Reuters." So one thing to note here is that, excuse me, this is about Israel-Palestine, but you have no idea if it's about Israel-Palestine right now if you read it. So there's no context. That's one of the problems. There is a source, Reuters, there's no link. So if you want to find out what Reuters article is that, there's no source, actually. And there's always a graphic video, which we don't know where it comes from. So another one with very emotional language comes from War Monitors. 71 Palestinian families have been completely erased from all public records after all their members got killed by Zionist regime. strikes on Gaza. This is genocide. And this is according to a source in Gaza. Do we know this source? No. Do we have any idea how to verify this source? No. And this is an opinion piece that depends on the source of Gaza, but we, as consumers of information in the crisis, have no idea how to verify it. You can agree or disagree to the statement, but in terms of the information space, we do not know how to verify it. So, this one comes from Censored Man. Censored Man was also pro-Palestinian a little bit. And they argued that there was going to be a ceasefire, but the problem was there was not going to be a ceasefire. And this is misinformation, actually. So they were posting a lot of things all the time, very frequently, without checking if the thing that they're posting is real, or correct, or verified, fact-checked. So, and you can build your life depending on this if you live in Gaza. If you think that there's going to be a ceasefire, you can actually change a lot of behavior around that information. So a lot of graphic, violent images. We try to pick the ones that are not showing the violent parts. We've seen a lot and enough for everyone. So one comes from funeral service for a Palestinian child with war monitors, and the second one from Sent Defender showing a Hamas militant getting killed in Israel. Very violent, and a lot of views on these without any verification strategies or any links to their sources. So, other content that might make actually the sides of this conflict very angry. So, Censored Man and other accounts posted stuff that was mocking Palestinians. So there were a lot of TikTok influencers in Israel that were mocking Palestinians being out of electricity and water. So they were showing, the Israeli influencers were showing that they have water and electricity in Israel. And they were posting, Censored Man was posting this to show that was happening. And this was from India, Visegrad published this, showing that, you know, they are disrespecting the Israeli flag. So if you are pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli watching these, you can feel that how much emotional reaction you can get looking at these tweets. So, how are they different than news accounts? So I'll give you one interesting example. So CNN tweeted something about and tweeted and also aired something about 40 beheaded babies rumor that Hamas killed, beheaded 40 babies in Israel in the attack. Later, this news was not verified, so it stayed as a rumor, but CNN aired it. Then they announced three corrections. CNN announced three corrections, and the person, the journalist who was on air when this news was on air, said that they are very sorry, and they said that they need to correct themselves on this case. But at the same time, in the same day, Visegrad tweeted about it, and I checked last week and this week again, there is no correction. There's nothing about it. And this tweet, if you go to their profile, you can still look at and see this tweet right there without any corrections. So there's one thing that we know about traditional news media, that they're not perfect. But we know that they have some selection and filtering processes when it comes to new information. When there is new information, we know how their process works. We know how they select it, how they filter it. But the problem with the new elites that when the new information arrives to them from a source in Gaza or from a source in somewhere else, we have no idea how they select it, how they filter it. We have one idea that the pro-Palestinian sources and the accounts always publish and post stuff that are pro-Palestinian, and the pro-Israelis always post things that are pro-Israeli. So there is some sort of an ideological screening. But other than that, we have no idea how they do it. Okay, so crisis events create a lot of information, and it creates a lot of demand for information. And it opens up our minds and hearts to finding out new sources, like the new elites, right? That means that our news environment is fragile, volatile, and it is very challenging to figure out what and who to trust in that kind of a environment where you need a lot of information in 2 hours or 1 hour, right? So one way to maneuver around online is SIFT method developed by Mike Caulfield, my colleague and co-author. And Mike is going to be the person to answer your questions. But basically, when you have a new information in crisis events or in any type of event, what Mike says to us that you should stop, investigate the source of the information, whatever it's tweet, website, anything. Then find better coverage, just search it online. Then trace those claims, those quotes, whether you can verify that. But one of the most important problems we faced during this conflict was when you search for that funeral service video, for instance, online, you wouldn't have the chance to verify it because there was nothing. So what Mike says to that is, what you need to do, what we need to do as consumers of information is to find some sort of a middle ground where we need to wait and critically ignore that information until we can verify it. So in those times when we need information, sometimes we actually need to wait to trust that information. So these posts that I showed you are only examples of those hundreds and thousands of tweets. And those posts with out of context can be very misleading. Posts without sources, links, make us very difficult to track and verify it. Emotional content and graphic violence might be disturbing. When we were writing the report, we got a lot of disturbance ourselves. Actually, we had to stop for a few days initially. And one problem is that when you have polarizing and emotional content combined with polarizing actors such as Hamas or Netanyahu government, it is very difficult to find places to compromise. And what we need is compromise to solve this of this great conflict, and what our information space is evolving and what our actors are behaving, it is becoming more and more difficult to find any ground to compromise. So, opportunities and challenges, as I said, news media. One thing to mention that we are not thinking that these seven accounts, these new elites, are citizen journalists. We don't think they are citizen journalists. We actually call them news brokers because they are not people who are posting on the ground. They're just broking. They're just brokers of that information, just tweeting from somewhere else, but not Gaza. Another thing to think about new media is that, is it democratizing our information space or is it creating oligarchies of our information space? If you look at these seven accounts creating 1.6 billion views, that doesn't seem democratic to me. That seems oligarchic. So we need to keep that in mind. And one thing to remind you is that these seven accounts are not misinformation accounts per se, but they are accounts that posted a lot of information. Some of those and most of those are problematic, but only some of those are misinformation. Another thing to keep in mind is that when we are in this kind of a crisis event, whether it's a conflict or anything else, the dosage of information consumption matters. So if you think of information as medicine versus poison, it depends on the dosage, right? So if you are, as a consumer, you need to think about it, and if you consume a lot of problematic information, at some point it becomes more poisonous than more helpful to you. Okay, and I'll give the floor to my coworkers and colleagues. And if you have any questions about crisis events, information space, crisis informatics, Kate Starbird is the person to ask. And if you have questions about SIFT method, anything online, Mike Caulfield is the person to answer those questions. And with that, This is the QR code to our report. And with that, I'll thank you.
Thank you very much. This is really, really exciting. We already have a list of questions, so I will go and you can just jump in depending on your areas.
Okay.
Okay. Why did you choose to focus on X as a miscommunication platform over other platforms like Facebook or WhatsApp?
I'd love to start out on that one. Yes. I think it's a context that is really important here because there's a couple of things happening. One is, Twitter. I'll talk about Twitter and X because Twitter is before it changed and then it's become X. And I think they're actually two different platforms now. Historically, Twitter was a place that did facilitate a lot of journalism. And as researchers, we also had really great access to Twitter data. So if you look at the history of social media research, a large portion would be on Twitter data because that data was public. And we felt like that also, it wasn't a perfect representation of what was happening online, but it was very good for breaking news events and for journalism. And so it became a site that really, a lot of activity and information seeking during breaking news events happened there. As it changes to X, and which is really what's interesting about this report, is the space changes, the rules of engagement change, and our access as researchers all of a sudden becomes greatly diminished. The fact that we have this data is a real testament to Mike and Mert and Ashlyn doing just an amazing job of figuring out how to get signal out of a very, all of a sudden, not transparent information space. Historically, we had great access, and now we don't, and it's changed, and we don't really know exactly how it's changing. But yes, we always had new elites emerging in crisis events, but something has become even stranger in this new era. Moderation has changed. It's harder to see what's going on there. And so it becomes a really interesting place. We think it's still an important place, but it's absolutely not sort of what it used to be, which was a thumb on the pulse of what was going on the internet all the time. It's not that anymore, and yet it's still influential in a lot of people's lives who get their information there.
Thank you. Can you expand on the trend of social media platforms that disproportionately censor pro-Palestinian discourses and reports?
I can start to that. And so one thing that we found in our report is we looked at the first 3 days of the conflict. And in the first 3 days of the conflict, when you looked at the Twitter or X, you find more Israeli voices. And why is that? Because in the first 3 days, there were more things happening in Israel than Gaza. So in the first 3 days when we were writing this report, we found more Israeli voices in terms of that. That I think that's natural to find. And the pro-Palestinian voices on X came a little bit lagged. But there were a lot of accounts, American accounts and international accounts that were supporting Palestinian voices, but it came a little bit later. But our report cannot talk to probably to that extent and how they were censored. As Kate said, we have no evidence of that and we have no way to verify that because Twitter is closed to researchers now.
And other platforms are following that as well. So as researchers, to be honest, we can't even answer those questions. We might have been able to answer them 18 months ago, 24 months ago. We can't answer a lot of those questions because the platforms have moved away drastically from transparency, both in just allowing researchers to see the data, but also transparency about the moderation practices and those kinds of things. They're just not visible to us in this, I would say, anymore. They were never perfectly visible, but they are even less visible and drastically less visible than they were 20 months ago.
So many college-educated Americans don't believe news reported by publications like the New York Times. Is this worrisome or a positive sign?
Yes.
Okay.
You want, I mean, we can answer, yeah. You know. Yeah. Does someone want to?
Sure, I can talk a little bit about that. You know, authority is contextual and constructed. Expertise is contextual and constructed. You know, one of the things that I think about in terms of information literacy is less about what the perfect source is and more about whether a person using that source understands what that source is, right? If they understand the context of that. And so, you know, if you're using the New York Times, it's good to have a little knowledge of their history covering some of these things. And to use that as a lens when you're looking at the New York Times coverage. If you're using some other publication, the Wall Street Journal, if you're using CNN, understanding the sort of strengths and weaknesses of these things in how contextual those strengths and weaknesses might be to a specific subject is important. I think when it comes to this group of people, one of the things that is difficult with these seven is it's very hard to tell who these people are at all, right? As Bert mentioned, we know a little bit about some of these accounts. We don't know a whole lot.
Isn't one of them an 18-year-old kid?
Yep. One of them was revealed to be like an 18-year-old kid in London that was posting in some ways, the presentation of that account was someone that was on the ground, but they were not. They were somewhere very far away, right? And so that's what we worry about the most, is that not necessarily about whether my source or your source is the best source, but whether when I'm looking at a source, do I understand what that source is, where it's coming from, to Mert's point, what the process they go through to select these things are. And the answer with these accounts is we don't have any of that context. For most of the accounts, not all, but most of the accounts, we don't have that context.
I notice the popular accounts, given we're all in English, not Arabic or another language, can you speak about the outreach to the English-speaking world?
So I'll just do a methodological note on that. We did use English search terms, and so I can't speak to the relative frequency of these. I think we did try initially to put some terms in that with different languages. I think the scale speaks to English language being a big piece of the outreach. But I'll hand it over to Mert to talk about the framing and so forth and how that fits into the English piece.
So this report is about English-speaking Twitter or X. So we didn't have time or expertise to look at different languages at the time, so we can't speak to those. But the extent of which you've seen these new elites is concerning or even, you know, interesting just for in English, because it's just 1.6 billion views is a lot of views, and that tells you a lot about the Twitter space itself. But we can't talk about the other languages and how different accounts were affecting those languages.
Historically, with crisis events, we would always see, whether it was earthquakes or Tahrir Square or those kinds of things, we would always see some new voices rise, mm-hmm. often with someone on the ground or someone who had specific expertise about a place or something was going on. I think the difference here is we've moved where we've got almost a total influencer culture. We thought we sort of got rid of gatekeeping with the old model of media. We got rid of gatekeepers. We have new gatekeepers, and there are these influencers that kind of emerge. And I think pieces of this were, so many of them had been specifically recommended or interacted with by one account who held a lot of power and holds a lot of power in one platform, and the effects of that and how that spreads out on other media is something that's remarkable. And just the kinds of, like, the accounts that are ascendant right now, that's not what the accounts that were ascendant looked like in Tahrir Square. Those were a lot of, like, people that were really there that were saying, you know, saying things that had a lot of local authority and or local knowledge about what was going on. And so the fact that there are new elites during a crisis event isn't so rare. The fact that they're so massive, that they're all kind of being recommended by one kind of person or that they're of all this kind of, like, this breaking news type, I think that the news broker type, mm-hmm. I think that is what's really kind of remarkable about this event and this information space.
If you think about citizen journalism and where citizen journalism gets some of its authority, it's because the idea, I talk in our information literacy work, rather than expertise, we often use this term position to know. Is the person in a position to know? And that is so that we cover things besides expertise. We cover things like lived experience. We cover things like indigenous knowledge. And we cover things like being a witness, being a person that is on the ground, right? And so people who are in a position to know have knowledge that a lot of other people are in the market for, right? And if you look and you think about the idea of citizen journalism, the idea is that someone might be in a position to know because they're on the ground, or because they've been following this topic for mm-hmm. a long time, or because they have a very very niche expertise that turns out to be incredibly useful at this moment in history. But again, that's not what we're seeing here. None of these people, as far as I can tell, have any sort of, they don't seem to be in a particular position to know. To use our term here, they seem to be more brokers of news than citizen journalists, just sort of feeding this stuff through.
So a number of questions about what can be done in that category. The first one is, what, if anything, should the American government do to regulate this news via social media phenomenon?
Not it. I think this is a challenging question for platforms and for us as a collective society, a democratic society. And at the same time, these platforms are not just U.S.-based. These are global platforms. What does it mean to have regulation in one place versus another place? I will say that the U.S. government probably not going to make a lot of progress on this anytime soon based on a lot of things. And also, we don't want, necessarily... these are challenging questions. There are regulations happening in Europe, in the European Union, the DSA, the Digital Services Act, and other kinds of things around a couple things. One of them I think is really important, we should be doing it here, and one of them is transparency. We should have more knowledge about what's going on in these platforms. I think there are also regulations that could have, like, the platform should be giving better signals about who these accounts are and where they come from for the people that are consuming news. I think that would be a set of regulations that many people could get around. Every account doesn't have to be that way. Like, people can still have anonymous accounts, but if you're going to be we should know what's happening and how certain accounts are mediating the conversation. We should be able to get the stuff that we had to figure out how to collect, and it's really challenging to collect, and we don't have great signals. We should have a better understanding as democratic societies, of just global societies, of, like, where is this information coming from? How much information, is coming from certain kinds of accounts. So I think a lot of transparency is a place that there could be a lot of regulation. In terms of moderation and labeling and what goes on which platforms, I think I am in of the group that, like, platforms should decide, and we should decide which platforms we use about what their rules are. Short of breaking the law, if they're illegal things, I think that's a place where the platform should be pressured. But I think there's some healthy discussion to be had there as well.
So how do we critically ignore while also bearing witness, as was suggested by Dean Woody in the introduction.
Yeah, so this is a real problem, and this is probably, I think, one of the more stressful points of this whole conflict in terms of social media. To set the ground of the problem. What we're talking about here is people that are consuming video after video, image after image of violent acts, and they're being fed this, and they're consuming this multiple times a day, multiple times an hour. And when we think about where that leads, if you talk to extremism researchers, they'll tell you that that's actually the first step, is that people become desensitized to violence through this constant exposure to it. And then people become more malleable in these ways. So we have to think about what bearing witness means and whether it is sort of, whether it's drinking off this fire hose of sort of inflammatory evidence, some of which is true, some of which is not, a lot of which in some ways is irrelevant. I mean, if you're looking for evidence that Israel is acting wrongly, there's no shortage of that, right? If you're looking for evidence that Hamas has acted wrongly, there's no shortage of that. So there's a little bit of a weirdness happening here too. And it's difficult to talk about, but I think nobody's served by consuming this sort of violent content day in and day out. And I think it's really harmful to society. People that do this sort of research and have to look at this stuff day in, day out will tell you how dangerous it is to be sort of mainlining this sort of content. And there are other ways that if you're interested in making the world a better place, there's other ways to help than to drink off this fire hose of this stuff coming from who knows where and out there to get you enraged, to get you malleable, to get you manipulable. And so critical ignoring is a term that comes from my work and Sam Weinberg's work, and part of what the idea is to kind of step back and say, well, what is it I want to know? What is it I'm looking for? What are my real aims here? And if I cannot know this thing here that I keep on refreshing, if I can't know if this thing is true, where can I focus my attention? And the idea is that our attention is limited. And when people grab our attention in this way and sort of suck us in, they kind of have us in their grasp. And so it's not, I want to be clear, it's not about ignoring the conflict. It's not about ignoring the evidence of everything that's going on here. But it is about thinking about how you engage your attention in a way that is productive and helpful to the situation, instead of being dragged along by seven people that seem to be picked randomly from the internet.
It's almost like a critical ignoring and critical attending. It's like, how do you just realize that your attention is the commodity, is the route of what the platforms are trying to capture, and is what these accounts are optimized to grab, and is part of also like how you're going to react as a human, as a political person, and all these kinds of things. Your attention is what this whole information economy is developed around, and be more intentional about your attention.
I guess the next question is to us, why isn't this talk live streamed? It's a question of resources, basically. That is one of the most expensive propositions, is live streaming these talks, so we have to be not selective, but budget our budget or something. I'm looking at Danny there, so. I'm not sure if this is something that comes across that you can answer, but the question is, why is the West's response to this war so different from the response to any other war?
Might be a bit out of my ken. I'll look down the table and see if anybody can pull on something. Probably Mert has the best sense of this from political
science. I have
opinions
about it. Yeah. Do I have evidence on the things that I can tell you? No.
Well, that's such you're a junior scholar, but you've already got that down, right? Like, to answer things about what we don't know is always gets us out on limbs that we don't necessarily want to be on. But.
Yeah. So we have theories, but not answers.
That's right. Yeah. I do that all the time. Now, this is interesting. Can you comment on the failure of the American education system to teach young people to think critically? The result is the public is less able to filter information.
Can I make one comment? Is that if we're going to comment on the failure of the American education system, we have to recognize that these challenges with people making sense of information, these information spaces, are not just among 18 to 25-year-olds. This is a K through 99 problem. And the world has changed. The information spaces have changed. There's a great need for our information literacies to catch up to the new information environment. But this idea that this is a TikTok generation problem, there's a TikTok problem. Like propaganda is on TikTok, absolutely. But that is not just characteristic of young people, I think, and recognizing that we're all vulnerable to this. We all have things to learn about how to engage in the information environment. I know I've been learning all along with this research, both from Mike and from my own experience of like doing it wrong and figuring out I need to be a better information participant. It is both a need for that education system to evolve, to be invested in, to have, I mean, that's a place where we can maybe do some political change. It's like we should be integrating this kind of education into our public education. Absolutely, that's going to pay off in 15 to 20 years, but we got to keep the world around in the interim, and so we have to, it's on all of us to become better educated about how to engage in these spaces.
Thank you. As experts on evaluating social media messaging, who do you see winning the conflict in electronic messaging and why?
Well, I think we know who's losing, and that's the people, I think, going to Twitter for their news. So
and for research.
Yeah. As far as who's winning, I mean, I don't... Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure. For me, that's the.
I think it's a lose situation.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that people are framing this for external audiences, and it's certainly the case that some of those frames are successful and some are not. But I don't know.
I mean, in the short term, there are people who are capitalizing on this fragmented information space. These dynamics that are. Attention economy dynamics. We certainly see people winning in that. As consumers, we're not winning right now in the information space as information consumers. And even as participants, I think people that go in wanting to help people be informed as opposed to wanting to make money and gain reputation, I think people that are engaging in these spaces to inform other people, generally speaking, are not winning, although we do have some cases where it does become an opportunity to inform. I think there's a lot of challenges there right now. So I don't want to paint a completely broken picture of some of these information spaces, and we do see new opportunities for people to branch out and share their voices. And I know a lot of young people find there's a place of power in terms of having agency in the world and helping educate others about things that they care about. We've done a great study of like accidental TikTok influencers who like really care about something and use their newfound attention to like educate people on the things they care about, and that's wonderful. So there are folks that, you know, there are these little stories, but the macro level right now, I think a lot of us feel that it's become harder to find information that we can trust, to figure out which information we can trust, and so there's some problems there. So there are winners and losers. It's not lose, but it's definitely a challenging space to seek information though.
I think this, Mark, you mentioned, kind of touched upon this in your presentation. What do future social movements look like as social media moves to siloed communities and broad consumption platforms fade out?
It's all you.
That's a Kate question. So it seems that the last decade, as I showed you in the presentation, that we have seen a lot of people tweeting and posting on the ground. I personally know how it went in Gezi Park protests, that you know most of the accounts that were posting were on the ground. But in the next decade of the social movements, if it is going to be similar to the Israel Hamas conflict, we might see fewer accounts posting on the ground and having traction, and we might have more news brokers, attention brokers accounts that are getting more attention online because they have the platform and they have the incentives to post more. So that might be even worse for the concept of citizen journalism in social movements and participatory nature of social movements in new media. So that's kind of, I'm very pessimistic, I know, but it might be the way that I would see it, yeah.
I think there's, you know, building off of that, social media do a couple of things in online platforms in interesting ways. One was to help people find other people like them who might have a set of interests and come together. And the other was to recruit broader audiences and garner solidarity. We see that in the Tahrir Square protests that social media are both used like for sharing information with people that were on the ground and for garnering solidarity. I think with it becoming more fragmented, that ability to garner solidarity from larger crowds may become a little bit jammed. The other thing that we see happening compared to so I was studying this stuff in 2010 to 2009 to 2013, well, there's great optimism, and we kept focusing on all the amazing things that social media were enabling, and things have become a lot less optimistic in recent years. But one of the things that is lost as we begin to recognize that we can't trust the information that we see there, people can't trust each other, it's going to be harder to organize. And so just as we recognize this, like, oh, this is great ability for people to organize mm-hmm. social change, I think that becomes disrupted and almost that you know, intentionally disrupted by some of these efforts that undermine our ability to know and to trust that the person we're talking to is someone that we could trust. I don't think that the protest you had at the time, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think you would be necessarily as comfortable even sharing that kind of information yeah. in the current environment, because it's just so flooded with bad actors who now recognize that they can use these to thwart positive social change as well.
There are some questions which I will skip because they're specifically about the war, and I think we'll have a chance to go back to them as we hear future presentations. But there is one here which I am really interested in, and that is there is this issue of responsibility that is at the core of a lot of what you've been doing and talking about. And this question goes, what responsibilities of obtaining accurate information falls on independent users, and what falls on the social media platforms, algorithms, creators?
This is, have you ever heard of the chilled researchers? This is the chilled researcher trying to figure out how to navigate this question in an environment where to say that the platform should take responsibility, you get accused of being a so-called censor of things. I do think there's, you know, platforms and the design of platforms have exacerbated problems that exist already, and they've created some new ones. Some of those platforms are motivated to solve those problems, and in that motivation have been accused of being biased by those who benefit from manipulating the spaces. Others of those platforms are not motivated to solve those problems. And so it is a challenge, and it's a real tension with commitments in the United States and other places to freedom of speech being balanced against these harms that these platforms are causing because of the design of the platforms and how they lift these really, exploitative accounts in some cases and just low-quality accounts in others. I don't exactly know the answer to navigating that. I know that some of the easy ones are for the platforms to be at least obligated to give better signals about what that information is, how it gets to certain users, who, how did that information get to you? When possible, being able to get that link to the source. What the X platform has done in recent months is to take away the links to the sources, right? And so we actually see platforms moving in the opposite direction. So in terms of like hard responsibility of the platforms like moderating content, I think there's room for that conversation. We might see some stuff happen in the European Union around policies around that. But short of that, there are a lot of things that platforms could be doing around transparency that I think many of us could get around. To agree on, and would be a little bit resistant to some of these bad faith accusations of bias. But to do that, I think we're going to have to lift our voices again. And right now, a lot of researchers are unable to do that because of some of the bad faith criticism of work like some of the work we've been doing.
Can I add something to that? So one thing that comes to mind in one of the easy solutions is that, censorship of these accounts or, suspending these accounts or creating solutions that might actually allow platforms or governments to censor these accounts or suspend these accounts, which is a problem. When you have actors in politics that are using censorship for their own purposes. So when you have a system that is working for, creating a nice, comfortable information environment and political actors are not exploiting their power, it works well. But when you are in Russia, when you're in Turkey, when you're in Hungary, when you're in Poland, you were in Poland now, that's not that of a big problem, when you're in Venezuela, when you're in places where political actors are the problem, not the information space, then you have given them power that, the European Union is doing this, so I can actually implement this as a democratization packet. And, look, if I want to go into the EU, I can use these laws and policies, and which is actually in political science we call that stealth authoritarianism. So it's a secretive way of doing authoritarianism. Oh, EU is doing that, but it's actually for your own profit. Yeah.
That's a great point.
So, with all this unverifiable disinformation, why not just ignore these platforms entirely? Mm-hmm.
As researchers, as individuals, or as society, I think there's one thing to say. I haven't been on X. I got run out of that place, but I haven't been on X for a long time. rest in peace, Twitter. But I haven't been on X for a long time. But that doesn't mean that what happens on X doesn't affect our lives, even if we ignore that. We can choose not to use TikTok, but that doesn't mean it's not impacting the other people that are seeing it. And so, as an individual, I can critically ignore a whole platform because I no longer have trust in that platform. But as a researcher or as a citizen, I think it's still really important that we understand what's happening on those platforms and then we have some visibility into the dynamics there and into the role that the platform dynamics play in lifting these accounts. It's one thing to say, let's not suspend those accounts. I don't think suspending those accounts for their activity would be the right thing to do. But it's another thing to be like, why is this platform, creating an environment where the most, the most viewed and most trusted accounts are spreading content that is so low quality? What is it about the design of those platforms that needs to be addressed? And that's, I think, a place where we should be collectively pushing.
Well, I think we have time for one more question. There are a lot of very interesting questions here, so thank you all for your interest. And This is about fact-checking. Fact-checking is difficult when facts themselves are contested. How should consumers of information navigate lack of trust and verification options?
All right, I have a book out. It's called Verified. You can all get it. So let me just briefly talk a little bit about how I see fact-checking, personal fact-checking, which I think is a little different than what a reporter does. When we think about what an individual sees something online, something in another space, they believe it has some significance. It's evidence of this, it's evidence of that. It goes against their beliefs, it supports their beliefs, something like that. What fact-checking is for an individual is an attempt to get a greater context, understand if this thing they saw, this thing that made them feel something or made them feel nothing, was inappropriately evaluated by them. If they jumped to a conclusion about the thing they were looking at that was not merited. And so now we have this thing, this sort of fire hose of inflammatory evidence that some of it is real and some of it is fake and some of it's miscontextualized. And it's all coming at people at a rate and a level where there is no time to look into the individual things. You're reacting to something, and then rather than going and saying, well, you know, is that real? Is that indicative? The next thing is coming at you, and you're reacting to that. And you're just becoming this sort of engine of reaction. For me, the answer is to step back and ask, why are you in the market for these things on Twitter or something else? And what you're trying to do is you're trying to determine whether your beliefs are justified, whether they should be intensified, whether they should be moderated, whether they should be expanded. And at some point, the answer to fact-checking is if you cannot verify this actual fact or determine this fact, at some point is to step back and say, well, what are the actual answers I need? One of the things you talked about in terms of this session is delving into the history of this, delving into the larger picture. And one of the things that these influencers, these news brokers do, is they pull you into a level of detail where you feel lost and overwhelmed, and ultimately I feel disempowered. And so if the facts are contested, if the individual facts of the day are contested, and if it's going to be a while before they're resolved, your attention, you own your attention, and you can put it towards trying to understand that larger picture, trying to understand the history, the context, trying to look at this through lenses that are bigger than the last inflammatory video that you're looking at. And so that's what I would recommend.
Well, Kate, Matt, and Mike, thank you very much for the wonderful work you're doing at the center and also for sharing your knowledge, participating in this conversation with us this evening. Thank you very much.